in this series of two on Moses, and the subject today is the pitched battle. I think that perhaps the most important thing for a Christian who's going to make progress in the Christian life is that they should have a right perspective. It's very easy for us to start looking at the world and its events in exactly the same way as men of the world look at it. And in fact, of course, this is to misunderstand the situation. It will also lead us into despair on occasions, a wrong kind of optimism on other occasions. Some peasants in western Spain, 20 years ago, still believed that the world was flat, that Protestants had tails, and that the Moors were trying to capture the whole country. And so a stranger who happened to visit them was greeted with considerable suspicion. He was almost certainly a spy. Those same peasants resisted any attempts to help them in developing their agriculture and giving them a more comfortable life. Their perspective was narrow, so their life was affected. When a Christian's perspective is narrow, his life, his Christian life, is easily affected. I believe that those who try and cut out the supernatural picture, the big canvas that is painted for us in the Bible, do us a great disservice. Modern theologians often come saying they're coming to release us from the medieval worldview of the universe. As often as not, they don't enlarge our view, they narrow it. They don't widen our perspective, they make it smaller. They say that we don't need to see this world in terms of a huge conflict between God supreme, a power of evil, subordinate but nevertheless active, and then man, the battleground. And yet I believe unless the Christian begins to see events and life in those terms, he won't understand what's going on around him. If there's one word which can be used to sum up the Christian life, it's the word conflict. When you come to Christ, you commit yourself to Him, you commit yourself also to battle. Crises like the Cuba crises and the Egyptian blockade of the Tiran Straits are simply, well, they're small reflections of something which is much bigger and much more terrible going on behind the scenes. The psalmist in Psalm 73 says that he was perplexed when he looked out at the world because he saw many things that didn't seem to match up with the convictions that he held about God. Particularly, the problem was, why do the wicked, the unscrupulous, the dishonest, so often prosper? Don't you see that in the city? The man who is thoroughly dishonest, quite ruthless, often is looked up to as a most delightful, charming person, and apparently gets away with all that he does, feathers his own nest, has a comfortable home, and dies a peaceful death. And the man who says, God is good, is left also saying, I wonder. Until, and this is where the psalmist gets the answer, until he goes into the sanctuary of God. And once the psalmist gets into the presence of God, he begins to see life from a different angle. Because he sees the beginning and the end. And he said, then I began to realize exactly how unsatisfactory the lives of those men whom I thought were so good was. Now, I believe what you and I need more than anything else is to get into the sanctuary of God and to begin to see life from God's angle. Now, in the life of Moses, you get Moses beginning to see the whole situation, the events that took place in his life, from God's angle. And you'll find that Moses, as soon as he got into the hands of God, found himself fighting. But he learned in his conflict various things. So let's get this right. The Christian perspective is of a conflict going on, and the battle, or the battles, are raging on three fronts. To use the theological language of the New Testament, on the front of the world, the flesh, and the devil. Now, to some extent, we saw how Moses had to fight with the world last week. He began to realize the tremendous pull of the palace and of education, and of those sort of things, giving him status and the rest. Now, you see him battling on two other fronts. And perhaps I can divide this talk into two parts. First of all, the battle God fought with Moses, And then secondly, the battle God fought through Moses. This is how God works his deliverance in the world. First of all, he has to win his battle over you and over me. So the battle God fought with Moses. It was Martin Luther who said on one occasion that there was one enemy whom he feared far more than the Pope, who was, I suppose, the one ranged most fiercely against him. The enemy whom he feared most of all was himself. Have you begun to see that enemy? Have you begun to fear that enemy? I think a Christian is one who's begun to realize just how deceitful he is in himself. And as you look at the biblical stories of all sorts of men of God, you'll find that the men who won great victories for God were the men who'd been completely defeated by God. I forget which admiral it was who had been defeated by Nelson. And he came onto Nelson's quarterdeck, marched up to him with his hand outstretched, and the words on his lips, "Greetings, Admiral. You have fought a good fight. You've beaten me." And Nelson turned his back on him. He said, "Sir, your sword first." And not until the sword had clattered to the deck at the feet of Nelson did Nelson turn round and shake him by the hand. Now, I believe it's rather like that with God. God doesn't meet us on equal terms. He comes and he says, "First of all, you've got to lay down yourself at my feet." And something within me says, "No, that I will not do." Now, this happens even in the lives of those who have committed themselves to Christ and gone some way in Christian experience. And I think that's exactly what you see happening in the life of Moses. Moses found it very hard to learn exactly how much his own heart was rebelling against God, but he began to discover it as God approached him and talked with him. I remember hearing of one man who came out of theological college, was appointed to a church in Australia, and he said that he could describe himself in these terms: as a man who came out with a towering sense of his own ability, coupled with an abysmal sense of his own failure. He said as he came to that small church, he regarded himself as God's gift to the church in Australia. He was quite sure that before long that church would be packed to the doors, that all the other churches would be complaining that they had now such an attractive, dynamic clergyman in their midst. And he said, to his great surprise, his own congregation, which was only a dozen, diminished after he arrived. And gradually he began to discover that he wasn't quite so great as he'd thought. And then he fell into despair. Moses began just like that. He came out from the palace with a towering sense of his own ability. And he struck dead the Egyptian. And then he found himself banished into the wilderness, living in a tent, with Jethro his father-in-law and Zipporah his wife. And he then felt an absolutely abysmal sense of failure. I believe that if there's one thing which you often see in the lives of Christians, it is this abysmal sense of failure. Now see how it comes out in the life of Moses as God approaches him and calls him to his work. Exodus chapter 3, first of all, and verse 10. Here is the beginning of an amazing conversation between God and Moses. God says in verse 10, "Come, I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring forth my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt." Moses, I'm calling you. Moses, you're going to be a great deliverer. Moses, you're going to bring my people out of bondage into freedom, out of darkness into light. You, says God, I'm calling you. I want you to be able to deliver those who at this moment are lost in darkness, who don't know where to go, don't know how to live their lives, and you're going to be the one who brings them out into joy, peace, the satisfaction of Christ. What does Moses say? You get his answer in verse 11. "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt?" Who am I? Do you remember Isaiah? He came into the temple, and it was the year that King Uzziah died. The throne was empty. But suddenly Isaiah saw another throne, which was full. It was the throne of God. The cherubims were crying out, "Holy, holy, holy." And Isaiah said the whole place was filled with smoke. And he went down on his knees and he said, "Woe is me, for I am a man of unclean lips and dwell amongst a people of unclean lips." And then God said, "Who will I send and who will go for me?" And Isaiah said, "Here am I." When Moses said, "Come, I will send you," Moses said, "Who am I?" And I believe that's exactly what happens today. The majority don't say, here am I. They say, oh, who am I? In other words, God, you haven't quite realized what you're dealing with. I'm not that type. Look, I'm not made that way. Don't you feel this? God says, look here, I want you to become one who can draw others into my kingdom. Oh, no, Lord, that's not my sort of job. Isn't that exactly how many people feel? And yet, how stupid, because if God had called Moses, didn't God know what he was doing? And if God has called you, doesn't he know what he's doing? He called those disciples, and he said, come, and then he said, go. He calls you and me as disciples. He says, come, and then he says, go. And how many say, what, me? Oh, no. Of course, his answer is very simple. God says in verse 12, but I will be with you. What else do you need? Do you see what had gone wrong with this man? He had thought of himself purely as the failure, and therefore God couldn't possibly use him. He'd realized one thing about himself. He'd realized his own weakness. But he hadn't realized another thing, and that is God's strength. And I believe that's exactly the position in which many are here. You know something of your own weakness. You've seen how you fail in the Christian life. And you don't trust God. And so you don't go when he calls you. And you're not doing what he's asked you to do. I was talking to a girl yesterday. She was very interested about the Christian life because she had a deep-rooted conviction that, in fact, the way in which you went to heaven was by living a good life. And the way to go to hell was to live a bad life. And she tried to live a good life and she'd failed. She decided she couldn't. So she said, right, I'm going to go to hell first class. And she decided to live it up. And I think a lot of people get to that stage. She was honest. And then she suddenly saw that, in fact, the Christian gospel was saying something else. It was saying that, of course, you couldn't live the good life that would take you into the presence of God, but God would nevertheless lift you up into it. She said, you know, that's too easy. And then she said, in the same breath, of course, it's too difficult for me. And then she went on to say, of course, I trust God. I've never doubted God. I said, you've never trusted him in your life. She was rather indignant. So I said, well, look here. This is what God says, that he can transform you. He can make you a saint. She said, I don't believe that. No, you don't trust God. If God is with you, what else do you need? Moses was to learn this lesson eventually, because after he had been through the wilderness experience, he discovered there was only one thing that mattered in life, and that was that the presence of God should be with him. And after the children of Israel had made a golden calf and worshipped it, God said to him, this is a stiff-necked people. I will have nothing more to do with them because my anger will grow too great if I have to go on persevering. But I tell you what you can do, Moses. You go up to the promised land with them. I'll send an angel before you. You'll find the milk and the honey. You can have it all. And I'll make a great nation of you. And Moses said, nothing doing. Sorry, Lord. An angel's not good enough. There's only one thing which makes it worthwhile for me to go up to the promised land, and that's if you will go with me. How desperately we need that attitude in the church today. How desperately that is required in St. Helens. Not, well, Lord, it's very kind of you. If we have an angel, that'll be marvelous. If we have the joy of things going well in the Christian church, milk and honey, that'll be tremendous. If we're going up towards the promised land, that's good enough for us. No, says Moses, that's not good enough for me. I want the presence of God, nothing less. How easy it is to be satisfied with the Tuesday services as they are, people sitting on the steps, and a full church, and a sense of joy as we listen to God's word, and many other Christians rejoicing in it. You satisfied? I think sometimes God has to say to us, you know, you can have my angel. Are you satisfied with that? A measure of blessing. Oh yes, some people come to a faith in Christ. You satisfied with that? Or are you saying in your heart, no, that's not good enough. I want to have the presence of God right in our midst, nothing less. I want to know God filling this place so that as men and women come in here Tuesday by Tuesday, week by week, they become overwhelmingly conscious of the holiness, the majesty, the greatness, the love of the Heavenly Father. Not just that this is a moving, active, going concern. That's not enough. Not just an angel. The presence of God. And you can have this in your life Are you satisfied with just the angel? Are you satisfied only with God? I will be with you, he says. Is Moses happy? No. Look how he goes on. Verse 13, his immediate reply to God. God has said, I will be with you. Isn't that enough? Does anybody need anything more than the presence of God? Surely that is the answer to all our problems. If only we could really believe the promise, I will be with you. But Moses has his answer, verse 13. Then Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? Look, Lord, don't you see, I wouldn't know what to say. How often I've heard that. The call to the Christian. Now you go to your office, you go to people in your home, your neighborhood, you bring them out of darkness with your words. What should I say? You see, don't you realize I'm not made this way? And I'm a very young Christian. I don't know my Bible. I can't thumb my way happily through the minor prophets and pick out verses. I'm not very good at learning verses by heart, and other people can quote freely, but I can't. I'm still a beginner. I can't find the passages that I ought to find in the New Testament, even. What should I say? Isn't this up to the minute? Isn't this exactly what so many people feel? And look how God answers Moses. He goes on in the following verses. Verse 14, God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, say to this people of Israel, I am has sent me to. What exactly does he mean by that? Well, just remember what had happened. Moses had come to the burning bush, as we were thinking last week, and he saw a most extraordinary phenomenon. He saw a bush, just like any other bush, and on fire this time. And yet, something was extraordinary about this fire, because the fire went on burning and the bush wasn't consumed. Most bushes that caught fire would burn, there'd be a great blaze, and then the blaze would go out. But not this blaze. This blaze continued to burn. That fire which went on burning was something which Moses came to know very well in the succeeding years of his life, because as they went through the wilderness, there was always the fire burning at night in front of them. A symbol of the continuing presence of God, the eternal, faithful, unchanging God. Moses, as he came to the burning bush, had learned something about God. He knew what God was like. So you see what God is saying to Moses. Look, go and say to the people what you know, what you've experienced, what you've seen. You've seen something about me. That's what I want you to tell them. Say, I am, has sent me. Isn't this exactly what he says to you and to me? Look, what I want you to go and do, says God, is to go and tell them what you've seen about me. Tell them your experience of God, not what you have felt, but what you've seen about God. What you know is true. Because you've become aware of it in your own experience. And is Moses satisfied? No, he promptly starts saying, well, Lord, it's all very well, but you know, actually they wouldn't believe me. I believe that this is exactly as we speak today. Look at the next thing, chapter 4, verse 2. This is how Moses goes on. Having said, first of all, who am I? He then says, what shall I say? And then when God says, I am, he says, well, they wouldn't believe me. Chapter 4, verses 1 and 2. But behold, he said, they will not believe me or listen to my voice, for they will say the Lord did not appear to you. Isn't that exactly what we feel? Look, you say, go and speak about my Christian experience. Do you know the people in my office? Do you know the people near me at home? They're not the sort of people who are going to listen to me talking about religious experiences. They'll say, look, don't get emotional. It's all your fantasy. Well, it's all very well for you, but don't start coming and bothering us. Isn't this exactly up to date? What does God say to this? It's all interesting. Look at verse 2. The Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? He said, a rod. And he said, cast it on the ground. So he cast it on the ground, and it became a serpent, and Moses fled from it. God says, what's in your hand? Well, just a staff, says Moses. Throw it on the ground. And Moses can't be seen for dust. Now, I think this is exactly what God does with us. What's in your hand? Well, says Moses, it's just a staff. I found a good tree. I cut it down. I've carved it out. It's quite useful to me. But just a bit of wood? What can God do with it? He can make it a most frightening instrument for persuading people. Moses drops it on the ground and he finds himself shaken. What's Pharaoh going to be? God comes to you and to me and says, what's in your hand? What have you got? Do you remember the widow? She'd been the wife of a man who was at a theological college, one of the sons of the prophets in Elisha's school. And then a tragedy had befallen her. Her husband had died. And she'd gone to Elisha and said, I'm in a desperate plight. You know how my husband was faithful to God. And now he's died, and I haven't been able to pay the mortgage for the house, and I haven't been able to pay the insurance premiums. I've got a huge debt. My creditor's ruthless. He's going to take my two sons as slaves unless I do something about it immediately. What shall I do? What does Elisha say? He says, what have you got in your house? Not in your hand this time. What have you got in your house? Now, he knew perfectly well she hadn't got any Rembrandts that she could take to Sotheby's and have sold. He knew perfectly well there weren't any 5-pound notes in an old stocking of hers somewhere in a back drawer. But he says, what have you got? And she says, well, as a matter of fact, I got one pot of oil. Oil was valuable in those days. It's valuable today. If you happen to have an oil well in your back garden, you're doing well. Good luck to you. But, of course, one little pot of oil won't get you very far. None of the Texan tycoons will come after you for that. And she says, well, what use is that? And so Elisha gives the instructions. Go round and collect all the receptacles you can. Go into your kitchen, shut the door, and pour the oil into it. She scratches her head, but she goes off and does it. Knocks at Mrs. Smith's door. Any pans? Any pots? Out she comes laden with pots and pans, frying pans, and pops them into her kitchen. Then down the road to Mrs. Jones. Then Mrs. Smith. And before she's been round quite a number, she's beginning to feel slightly embarrassed. The whole neighborhood now know that she's collecting pots and pans. They wonder if they better take her round to the mental institution round the corner, because obviously something's going seriously wrong with her life. And eventually, perhaps she says, well, I can't go to Mrs. Smith. I can't face it. It's too much. And so she goes back into the kitchen. She obeys Elisha's instructions. She shuts the door. She gets her sons, and she starts pouring out the oil. And to her amazement, she pours out into the first pan, and it fills right up the top. There's more oil in the pan than there was in the little cruse. And then the next, and the next, and the next, and so it goes on. Hey, Johnny, got any more pots? Look up in the attic, will you? The whole room is now full of pots of pans, full of oil. But have we got any more? Oh, I wish I'd been to Mrs. Smith. According to your faith, be it unto you, what have you got, he says. What can God do with that? Do you remember Philip and Andrew and the little boy? He's got 5 loaves and 2 fishes, but what are they among so many? What have you got in your hand? What have you got in your hand? That's what God uses. You say, I haven't got a mind. I haven't got gifts. I'm not a big personality. I'm not the kind of person who makes a great impact. I'm not a great leader. What have you got? It may be just dirty old bit of wood. And yet God can use what you've got if you will obey him. That's the lesson Moses had to learn. Is he satisfied? No, dear old Moses is exactly like us. He promptly comes back with his next excuse. And these are all excuses. Notice that. He says, verse 10. But Moses said to the Lord, O my Lord, I am not eloquent, either heretofore or since thou hast spoken to thy servant, but I am slow of speech and of tongue. Look, Lord, you know, I've been wondering, but even as you've been speaking, I find it just as hard to choose my words as I'm speaking to you. You know, I thought that perhaps if you really meant me to go out and persuade people with an eloquent voice, then perhaps whilst I was talking to you, something would happen. But nothing's happened. I can't do it. Isn't that exactly like us? And again, what does God say? He's getting a bit more impatient now, if I may put it that way. This is using very human terms about God, but it's a lovely way of beginning to see the deep personal relationship there is. And God says, look, who made your mouth? Who is it that makes man deaf or dumb or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Don't you realize, Moses, who I am? And then comes the last straw. Verse 13, but Moses said, O my Lord, send, I pray, some other person. And then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. Do you see, God has answered every single problem that Moses had, and at the end of it he says, O Lord, send some other person. Nay, Lord, I don't think I'm really the person to do this. How many Christians there are who have had exactly that same excuse on their lips? I will guarantee that most here have at some time said just that to God, because God has called you and you've said, well, nay, Lord, send somebody else. You know, this isn't me what you're asking. It's all very well for these men who wear black and stand up in the pulpit. It's all well for the professional Christian. But you know, I'm just an ordinary person. I've got a busy business life. Not for me, Lord, no. How foolish. And so God has to do what he didn't want to do. He says, all right, I will make Aaron your mouthpiece. Aaron will speak to the people, you will speak to Aaron. How sad, Moses, you've missed the greatest privilege any man can have, the joy of being the mouthpiece of God. I wanted you to have that. You were able to do it, but you've chosen not. Will you miss out on what God has called you to do? Will you miss out on the most exciting experience that is possible for a man in life? John R. Mott was a remarkable missionary leader at the end of the last century, the beginning of this. He inspired many students in universities particularly. He caught a vision of what God could do throughout the world. He was a man of big personality and of great spiritual impact. He went around speaking and organizing many missionary activities. I think it was in the 20s that the President of the United States, President Coolidge, called for him and said, Mott, I want you to be one of my senior ambassadors. And John R. Mott's reply was, Sir, some years ago I was called of God to be his ambassador. Since then I have been deaf to all other calls, because in comparison they seem so unimportant. Have you got that picture? God calls, as well as calling to his discipleship, he calls to his service. How easy it is to make excuses. But Moses eventually laid down his sword. He allowed God to start to work through him. And then you find the next battle. God has won the battle in his own life. Not that this battle didn't have to go on being fought, but the main issues had been realized. Moses had recognized himself as a failure, but God as a success. That's all that's needed. I want to realize that I can't do it, but God can. Then I'm on the way to being used as a deliverer. So comes God's battle through Pharaoh. Dear, I haven't left enough time. Let me just point out some salient things in the battle. I won't be able to turn you to the verses, I'm afraid. But briefly, they're these. Moses came to Pharaoh, and instead of it all working out easily, he found Pharaoh was absolutely adamant that the people were not going to go. And it was one plague after another that had to take place. The battle raged day after day after day. Moses had to go and face that man, who was a pretty formidable person, day after day after day, fearlessly, and say, God is going to do this unless you let them go. Now, what is the great lesson from this? Well, I believe it's just this. People don't easily come into the kingdom of God. Do you think it's just a matter of bringing a friend along and letting them hear the preaching and everything else follows? Do you think this is the way in which men and women are going to be delivered from the bondage of sin and brought into the freedom of Christ? No. There's a battle that's got to be fought, and it's fought by Christians who will take God seriously and who will recognize that there's a power of evil who blinds the eyes of those who believe not and is going to stop them coming into the kingdom if he possibly can. Why is it that some churches seem to get nowhere? Why is it that some Christian works seem to just have no impact at all? Again and again, because men don't see the lesson of the story of Moses, that you're not going to easily rescue people out of darkness, that there's a Pharaoh, a power of evil, because I'm sure that's what he represents, who is going to hang on unless people come with that invincible confidence that God will eventually break through. That's the first thing. The second thing to notice is that Moses will take no compromise. Pharaoh, as soon as he finds himself really pushed, begins to suggest various compromises. He first of all says, well, look, right, all very well. If you want to go and worship God, go and do so, but don't go out of Egypt. Just what I hear so often. Religion's all very well, but don't really make a complete break with the world. We don't like these Christians who become completely otherworldly, who become so different from us that it's really rather an embarrassment. Isn't that exactly what you find? Second thing that Pharaoh tries, Moses says, no doing. We're going out of Egypt. So Pharaoh says, well, all right, if you must go, then go out into the wilderness a little way, but not too far. In other words, it's all very well. Religion, we recognize, has got a place in this world, but you mustn't be fanatical about it. Don't start trying to persuade other people to be you know, these wholehearted Christians that start giving a tenth of their money and have to run Bible classes and attend Bible meetings and church regularly every Sunday and all this sort of thing, start talking about Christ at embarrassing times in the middle of the day. This is a bit fanatical. And so Moses says, nothing doing. She says, all right, who are you going to take? Moses says, we're going to take everybody. Pharaoh says, look, the men can go, but not the women and the children. In other words, look, don't allow this to encroach into your family. If you want to be fanatical, well, if you want to have these outmoded ideas, fair enough. But don't start trying to persuade your children. Let them have a fair chance to choose for themselves. Moses says, nothing doing. So then comes the last thing, right, says Pharaoh, you can go with your children, but you leave your cattle behind. In other words, don't let your religion encroach on business. Those two are quite apart. You know, if you start mixing religion and business, then there's really going to be trouble. You can't do it, you know. Keep your Christian life, that's good. We want businessmen who've got fine characters, but don't try and start praying over business. Honestly, that's not the sort of thing you do. You see the battle raging? And you'll find that when you're trying to deliver people, these are the sort of things that they'll try and stop you doing, bringing people right out into complete commitment to Christ. I could go on and show you a number of other things. The way in which as soon as Moses starts to do this, Pharaoh makes it tougher for the people of Israel. And the people of Israel begin to say, look, why did you have to cause this trouble? As soon as you come and start stirring up the Christian gospel, or stirring up people's thoughts by the Christian gospel, people will say, look here, why did you have to bring this bother to us? We were quite happy before, and now you're causing all this trouble. I remember at a school, some of the girls had become Christians. And before long, they'd been coming down to the church where I was a curate. And before long, the headmistress had me up there and said, look here, why are you causing all this trouble in the school? Before this, we had quite enough religion with the assembly, and now, here are some of these girls becoming quite fanatical. And it spoiled the peace of the school. People are getting across each other. How often that happens? But it was just the preliminary for the most tremendous work of God. Well, I'm sorry, we haven't got more time for that. But the battle that God had with Moses, and the battle God fought through Moses, that's the conflict. Let's close with prayer. Father, grant that like Moses, we may be willing to obey your call. But unlike Moses, may we not resist, assuming that we know better than you. Give us trust. And then give us that invincible confidence as we go out, so that we don't take no for an answer. We ask it for the glory of your name. Amen.